Good afternoon. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School, with you at High Notes. And this is week four of our 2015 season in Aspen. We are broadcasting on Aspen Public Radio as well as in PEPCA Auditorium with a wonderful audience. And we're with an old friend. Maybe that's the wrong way to put that. A young person who is an old friend of the music festival and school, and a young person who is a brand new friend. So we're excited about this program. With us is Alyssa Weilerstein and Rafael Pajari. So I thought I would start, I'm going to give you the briefest of mentions about Alyssa because she is one of those people who truly needs no introduction. But Alyssa's parents, Don Weilerstein and Vivian Hornick Weilerstein, have been over the years very important faculty members and guest artists both here in Aspen. They are returning this summer to the faculty, which is very exciting to me. Thus, Alyssa and her brother Joshua began coming as very tiny children or possibly babies.
Babies.
Yes. Thus, have a very long and happy association with us. But as has been true in the past seasons, Alyssa is with us as a soloist this season, and we'll talk more about her appearances in a moment. Alyssa is, of course, a recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship and is one of the most really important soloists on cello before the world today. So that's my introduction. Rafael, I'm going to go into some more detail because he's not as familiar to our audience, although he is known really around the world now as one of the most exciting conductors of his generation. I have his bio in front of me, but I'm going to put it all in a different order. This is from Asconis Holt. Okay. Yes, and it doesn't mention Aspen. Rafael began as a horn player and came up through the remarkable system of musical education in Venezuela, which is called El Sistema. And this is the original El Sistema. The movement called El Sistema has now spread all over Latin America, in the U.S., I believe in Canada now.
Yes, and yes. Even Australia and Japan and so many.
Australia, places. Japan, yeah. All over. But the original idea was a remarkable man named José Antonio Abreu, mm-hmm. and he founded it in Venezuela, where it's been going for how many years?
40 years now.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. But hundreds of thousands of young people in Venezuela receive a very intensive and very beautifully designed education in music. And it's actually more than that. It's a sort of entire social welfare, well-being program. I don't know if you want to say anything.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the whole idea of Maestro Abreu, when we built this, was that everybody should be entitled to have the opportunity to actually be educated in music. So he, over the years, of course, with a lot of strategic and a lot of vision, he tried to put this that everybody... At the better, the more that they could get education in music, they would be better person. It doesn't matter if they will actually become musicians or not, but the whole idea is that everybody should be entitled to be in touch with music. And well, we all know once music is in your life, you cannot put it away. So, yeah.
So, having been principal horn, one of the structures in El Sistema is that every community has a unit, but then when children show particular talent, they may be gathered into regional and then national orchestras. And the capstone of this is called the Simon Bolivar Orchestra. They tour the world. As principal horn of Simon Bolivar, Rafael worked with Giuseppe Sinopoli, Claudio Abbado, Simon Rattle, Lauren Mazzell, many others going all over the world, and then moved into conducting. As a conductor, I'm just going to give you a few highlights. Rafael made a very celebrated debut with Vienna Philharmonic, substituting for Claudio Abbado. Do I have that correct?
To Maestro Mazzell, actually.
Oh, it was Maestro Mazzell. Okay. And also, in the past season, has had debuts with the Philharmonia Orchestra, the Symphony Orchestra Hamburg, the Chicago Symphony at Ravinia, Bamberg Symphony, Seoul Philharmonic, the Danish National Symphony. Will make his opera debut with Royal Swedish Opera in Madama Butterfly, has previously worked with London Symphony, Munich Philharmonic, the Rotterdam Philharmonic, City of Birmingham Symphony, Oslo Philharmonic, Gothenburg Symphony in Sweden, Cincinnati Symphony, Los Angeles, and Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestras. I think that's only a partial list.
Just to name a few.
As a nice sidelight, one of the most important competitions for young conductors in the world is in Denmark, and it's called MALCO. And a generation ago, David Robertson won MALCO, and that was the beginning of his great career. In recent years, Joshua Weilerstein, who has some relationship to this family, also won MALCO. That was, I think, right before he came to Aspen. Yeah. But in 2012, Raphael won the first prize at MALCO. And another thing I want to mention is that Raphael comes to us to make his debut in Aspen next week, direct from the Castleton Festival. Castleton was begun by Maestro Lauren Mazel at his own property in Virginia, outside Washington, D.C. In the years since Maestro Mazel began it, it's become really one of the most celebrated summer programs in the world. And, of course, Maestro Mazel passed away recently. And the baton, literally, has been passed to Raphael, who is now principal conductor at Castleton.
Thank you.
I've also learned that Alyssa Weilerstein has also joined the faculty and their artistic leadership, officially as leader of chamber music, but is actually a kind of duo leadership of the whole Castleton enterprise. Is that how you would say it?
Yes.
Okay. I realize I'm talking a lot, so you should just jump in at any time. One thing I have not yet mentioned is that Alyssa and Raphael have recently married. So let's go to the story of how you met.
You met. Ladies first. Yeah.
We met 6.5 years ago in Gothenburg, Sweden. And that was actually my first encounter with Gustavo Dudamel. I played for him because, when you want to work with, when a soloist wants to work with a conductor, very often they play for them first. So I did. And Rafael at the time was still principal horn of the Simón Bolívar Orchestra. And Gustavo had invited him to play in Gothenburg. In Gothenburg, the Gothenburg Symphony was actually Gustavo's first music directorship outside of Venezuela. So we met very briefly, and then 10 months later, Gustavo invited me to play Dvorak Concerto with the Simón Bolívar Orchestra. And the rest is history, as they say.
Indeed, yes.
So was it mutual, or was one of you ahead of the other?
I think it was just, it just happened. I mean, it wasn't like we were trying to do something. It just, after the, in fact, because we didn't speak much in Gothenburg, in Venezuela, we didn't speak much either. I was sitting at the audience, you know, just having a little bit of a listen. She came like, how do you feel the balance? And it was good, fine. But then afterwards, there was one party at Maestro Abreu's sister's house. And, well, now we are together for 6.5 years.
Great. I don't know if you have any stories. I recall from Facebook that you had sort of two big parties. You had one down in Venezuela and one in the States.
Yes. Because especially Rafael's family is huge. My family is very tiny in comparison. So we had a wedding at Caramore, where I've also had quite a long history going there, and it's very close to New York City, and so it was convenient for my East Coast people to come. And so we had a smallish ceremony there, and we had a very big party in Venezuela 6 days later and on the island of Margarita. So this was very, very beautiful. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, let's turn to this summer for a moment. I mentioned that Raphael is just come from Castleton in Virginia. There you had two big assignments, Gounod's Romeo and Juliet, which we just finished a run of here in Aspen. I don't know if you weren't here in time
to
hear.
Well, actually, when I was coming from the airport, I was listening into the radio. That was the performance, so yes.
Okay. And also of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which is a little thing. But Alyssa told me a marvelous thing about that performance, and why don't you tell everybody?
Sure. I was at Castleton for a few days, I guess a week and a half ago, and they needed more cellists for this performance. So I got to sit in, and I played my very first Beethoven 9 ever. This was really fun. Yeah. The conductor was okay, you know. It was all right.
And you sit with Leslie.
That's true. I sat with Leslie Mazzella, Maestro Mazzella's oldest son. So we sat, who's a very, very good cellist, actually. So we sat together. So that was quite a quite
wonderful.
Quite
what chorus do you use there?
Well, the interesting thing about Castleton is because it's a opera training seminar. We use actually all the singers there are training to be opera singers, but we also use them on stage for chorus. So the base was 40 singers in training to be, and we add a little bit of chorus around Washington area, and we put together a chorus of maybe 70 persons, 75 persons, and we did a lot together.
Fantastic. I want to tell a little story about Romeo and Juliet, which will sound a little as a detour, but we're going to work it in a funny way later. We were doing here and in Castleton the Gounod opera, which was the height of romantic opera. There's also, of course, the ballet by Prokofiev. And at Berkeley, our director here was constantly joking that you needed to come to see the show to find out what happens at the end, or he would be assuring everybody that they will die at the right moment at the end. But it's not such a joke, because when Prokofiev debuted his ballet, Romeo and Juliet, sort of at the insistence, I think it came all the way from Stalin to him, that it must have a happy ending. And so indeed, in the very last scene, Juliet wakes up just in time and says, "Wait, Romeo.
Don't take the poison.
Right, things are okay." And Prokofiev, much against his will, actually wrote music that would accompany the happy ending, and of course put in his drawer the music that was the real ending, not as happy. Then, because of the twist of fate that Stalin and Prokofiev died on the same day, mm-hmm. I believe Prokofiev never heard the real ending in live performance. So that's just a sidelight, but yeah. You'll see how we work that in. I regret to say that if you missed last night's chamber music concert, you missed a sensational performance of Schoenberg's Verklärte Nacht sextet with Alyssa leading the cellos. I thought it was an especially refined Verklärte Nacht, which was interesting.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, is that something that you and Alex Carr was the concertmaster for the group that you say, this time we're going to do it this way, or?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we had an incredibly short time to put this together. So we rehearsed, I think, 6 hours in a space of 24 hours. Hmm. So it was very, very quick. And so we had to be incredibly efficient and very concentrated as to how we would do it. And it was a very mixed group. I mean, I've played with Alex many times together. We did Beethoven Triple Concerto. We've done Beethoven Archduke Trio. And a long time ago, we actually played a couple of Brahms piano quartets. But we had never played this together. And of course, there were three wonderful students who played with us, and the wonderful Sabina Thatcher as well, but we had never played together. So we had to really learn sort of the psychological things going on in a very, very short period of time. And that's actually something that I really, really enjoy about playing chamber music, and also working with conductors in different orchestras, trying to make that on a chamber music on a large scale. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to see what works and what doesn't.
So we think of this as an Aspen model, a string sextet, where there's one distinguished guest artist, Alyssa. There were two faculty members, Sabina mm-hmm. Thatcher and Alex Carr, and there were three students mm-hmm. Working with them. So you get the freshness, also the mastery of the whole experience.
Right, right, absolutely. And it was a really, really nice working relationship, and of course we had to work out details and trying to refine as much as we could while, you know, being so true to the really fraught and passionate and almost desperate character of so much of the music.
Mm-hmm. So in Castleton, will you do something similar? You have opera singers in training. You have young musicians, but you don't give lessons there, I don't think.
Well, we will. That's the plan is to really expand that, to have lessons and master classes, and to really give as much attention to the orchestra players as there are already to the singers. There's a fantastic vocal program there now. Mm-hmm. But what the goal is, to really involve everyone in an intensive chamber music program, as well as the symphonic and opera programs.
Huh. So next for you, I think, in Aspen is Sunday, the Aspen Festival Orchestra concert at 4 p.m., and you'll be playing Prokofiev's Symphonie Concertante.
Correct, yes.
So here we come back to Prokofiev. And tell us where that work fits into his career, what music is written around it, what is it like?
Well, it's interesting because it's actually an expansion of the concerto that he wrote for cello and orchestra in the 30s. This is, of course, a very late piece. I think it's around 1949. So it's one of the last major pieces that he wrote. And as many of the works of that time for cello, this was written in collaboration with a wonderful cellist, Rostropovich. And Rostropovich was heavily involved with constructing this and even, you know, figuring out some technical things for the cello. It's one of my favorite works to play. It's just incredibly rich, has every emotion that one could ask for. It also has a very unusual structure. It's fairly long concerto. It's about 38 minutes. And the second movement, there are three movements. The second movement is twice as long as the outer movements. So it's a kind of an epic piece in itself. It's one of the most difficult cello parts in terms of virtuosity, physicality, and just sheer power needed to bring it across. But this is something that I really enjoy. I enjoy the challenge of it and just the richness of material. It has fantastic, very romantic melodies, along with, you know, demonic characters and extremely virtuosic passages and wonderful orchestration, and it's just, every time I open the score, I find something really wonderful and new in it. So I'm really looking forward to bringing it here.
So at that time in the late 40s, how does it fit in? Prokofiev didn't have as dramatic a swing, right, in terms of his relationship to Stalin, right, as Shostakovich did, but he still did change,
yes,
back,
yes,
and forth.
And in fact, of course, to get anything played in public, all of the works would have to go through a bureaucratic party committee. They would have to be played for them before they were allowed to be presented to the people. So there was a very funny story, actually, that, of course, Rostropovich came before the committee, and this was when he was still in the good graces of the party leadership. That would change in about 15 years when he became friends with Solzhenitsyn, and then everything went downhill for Rostropovich. But this was still when he was in the good graces of everyone. So he came with a pianist. Prokofiev played the orchestral part, the piano reduction. And there are a couple of very dissonant chords. Not a whole lot, actually, but there are some very, as I said, some very demonic moments. So before the committee, which really didn't know much about music at all, of course, they modified these chords to make them very, very tonal and sound almost baroque-ish, so that they could pass the committee. And it did pass the committee, so this was... And if you'll... I think, Alan, you might know the moment in the second movement which I'm talking about. There's a minor ninth, and it's in the brass. It's sort of, you know, deliberately ugly. Just the one moment, and it sounds it's very sarcastic, and you might hear a sort of similar thing in some of Shostakovich's music, but just this moment. And so it was this chord that they changed completely to sound very nice, so that it could pass and be thought, okay, this is not formalism, this is not, this is music for the people. So.
Well, so then in performance, they just said, oh no, our bad. We
Pretty much. Well, this is, during the thaw, they could be a little bit more liberal about what they were actually presenting. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to turn to Raphael's program. This will be a week from today. with the Aspen Philharmonic. That's at 6 p.m., and so that's July 29th. Is that the right date?
I think so. I'm not so sure.
I think that's right. it's a beautiful program. It's with pianist Joyce Yang, who's, of course, familiar to us since her student days in Aspen. And Joyce will be playing, I don't know the order, but Liszt's Totentanz, Dance of Death. This is a spectacular piece. It really must be heard. And then, for quite a contrast, Falla's Nights in the Gardens of Spain. So what's that first half going to feel like to us, and do I have the order correct?
I think you're right. I'm not really sure, but I think that's actually the correct order, yes. Mm-hmm. What is beautiful about this in the way they was programmed also is because, of course, the Totentanz have the Dies Irae, which is also in the Symphonie Fantastique. And with Falla and the Garden of the Night of Spain, there's a lot of colors and a lot of fantasy that it would perfectly fit as well with the Symphonie Fantastique. So, yeah, I think it was very clever programming. It wasn't my idea, but it was very good, the one that did this program. Yeah.
So it was not your idea, but you agreed immediately.
Yeah, sort of, yes.
Well, I should have mentioned, the second half is Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. So I guess what Raphael is saying is that it's the Berlioz that spins off into the Liszt or into the Falla.
Yeah, because of course the Berlioz is full of colors and descriptions, which the Falla is absolutely is. And of course, with the fantastic way that leads with this Dies Irae that we would hear in the fifth movement of Symphonie Fantastique, it will be like having a full ride, even though there are three completely different pieces. But that's what I think, that it was very, very clever programming, and it's going to be very interesting. I'm not trying to sell you to come to the concert, but...
Yes, everybody should come. Tell me about your repertoire. Are any of these three pieces a first for you?
Both piano pieces are going to be the first time that I do it, yes. But Symphonie Fantastique is an old friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. And it's going to be very interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful. When I start studying the piano pieces, I used to see this wonderful, of course, I've heard it earlier, but have never worked on it to try to conduct it. And then you could see all these images and the Garden of the Night of Spain. You could even have those flavors. You could feel the olives and the prosciutto and the nice wine on it. So it is great. And then you go to the Creationism and Symphonie Fantastique. And then, of course, you want to die with the composer and you want to have opium with him and just go to the... So, yeah.
I'm not sure I want to have opium with Berlioz.
No,
but,
musically, yes.
Okay. As a little anecdote, one of the fabulous things in my position is that I can say to Asador Centurion, why don't we have more Sibelius? And, pal, we'll have Sibelius. So in my first summer, I said, why don't we have Nights in the Gardens of Spain? And my recollection is that it took me about three times before Asador said, are you serious about this? And I said, I am completely serious. And so this is now the second time we will have had it during my 10 seasons. But it's a particular favorite piece. I am old enough to have heard Alicia de la Rocha play it. So I don't know how many of you had this experience, but it was quite fantastic. And now Joyce Yang. So I wonder if you, Raphael, will have a chance to work with our student conductors or meet them, or...
I have no idea.
Well,
I don't know. I do know that I will be leading one of the sections for the orchestra that usually is made by the faculty, but they integrate me this way so I could have a little bit more close contact with the students. Yep. But I don't know about the conducting student. I mean, I don't think so, but I don't know.
Okay, because I actually don't know your age, but I'm suspecting that some of the student conductors are older than you are, possibly.
I don't know how old they are. I'm 35 years old.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the age of, I think, one of them.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah. And there you go.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Well, I mentioned a little about Alyssa's brother Joshua, who is conducting later in the summer.
Correct, yes.
And her parents, Donald and Vivian Hornick-Weilerstein, who are coming next week?
Yes. Yes, right. Next Monday, I think.
And I think this year you don't have a performance with them.
We do not, no.
But it'll just be family hangout, and the family is increasingly musical.
Yes. I'll still be here when they arrive, but my concerts actually will be finished here. But by the time they're missing my concerts. But they'll hear Raphael's.
Yes. So. Since they will not have an opportunity to be at High Notes, maybe you'd tell us a little about what they do in the summer.
Well, they go to the Yellow Barn Festival in Vermont. So it's a very, very intensive chamber music program. And they are, as you said, they're returning to Aspen. And this is actually the longest period of time they've spent here in many years. Because, of course, they were on faculty for, I think, 25 years. So, I mean, I literally did grow up coming here. It feels like a second home to me. They're very happy to come back, of course.
Oh.
Yeah.
Raphael, do you keep up with the horn? Do you still play?
I try to keep my embouchure going, yes, but I do not play in public
anymore. Oh, really? Because I was thinking there could be a Brahms trio, a Ligeti trio in our future.
Maybe not this time.
Okay, yeah. we should plan that.
I think it'd be great.
Yeah.
Great, fantastic. Well, in some of the previous High Notes, I have neglected to go to the audience in time for enough questions, so I thought I might see if you have questions, comments, thoughts for Alyssa or Raphael.
This is really not a question, but I live in Maryland, and I go to Castleton, so that I want to congratulate you on your new position there. It's a very exciting prospect, because when the maestro died, the question was on everybody's mind, what's going to happen at Castleton? And rather than shrink, they are expanding, and it's going to be good for the entire area and hopefully for the country.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's great to hear.
How many years did you have with Maestro Moselle there?
Well, the thing was that when I won the Malco competition in Copenhagen, he was the president of the jury. And as part of winning the competition was that I was going to have an invitation to come to Castleton, which actually happened that same year. And it became some kind of mentorship with him. And I went there. It was quite funny because it happened actually on the night of the dinner gala after the final. I have to catch my plane to go back to Venezuela very early. So I just went to say thank you very much. And he was like, no, don't you think that you're going to get rid of me that easily? You will be coming. That was May 12th, 2012, you will be coming on July 7th to conduct Leonora 3 over 2. I will be conducting Beethoven 9, and I will send you my score. And I was like, okay, sure, why not? So I went there and got immersed in this wonderful, because it's a little bit the festival is. It's very intense, but it's also the way they do it is a little bit like family-like. So everybody is involved, everybody's pretty much going to the same places. It's a lot of intense work. And we talked about music, about life. Then he immediately invited me to come next year to do Mahler 5. So I came, and then I was going to come to have actually a concert together with Alisa, and he was going to conduct in the same concert. He will be doing some arias from different operas, and I was going to conduct Alisa, but that same week was the week that he passed away. And so my relationship with him was always very intense. Last time, unfortunately, that I saw him was in this festival that it was done in Warsaw for the 80th anniversary of Krzysztof Penderecki. And we both were invited there to conduct some of Penderecki's pieces. And we talked about, it was great because the way he talked to me, it wasn't about technique or anything in particular. It was much more of the bigger picture of life, of music, of how to do stuff. And of course, I went to him when I have some, let's say, advice for career, some things that were being offered to me. I always ask him, Maestro, what do you think about this? What do you think? What's your opinion? What's your input in this? So unfortunately, it wasn't long enough, but it meant a lot to me, actually.
Yeah, I meant to mention that the great Polish composer Krzysztof Penderecki invited Raphael to take part in his 80th birthday celebrations, which were in Warsaw. So let's take a pathway into new music and your work with living composers.
Yes, indeed. I met Maestro, I met Krzysztof Penderekis when he came to Venezuela actually to conduct the Simón Bolívar Orchestra in the Seven Gates of Jerusalem when he did it there. And of course I was the solo horn, so let's say that we knew each other from afar. But how we actually, let's say that it was the real link, it was that he was the composer that did the obligated piece for the competition that we just received a month before the competition was set. So we premiered it there. And because things in Venezuela with the postal is not great, I received my score actually only 2 weeks prior to the competition. But thanks God, it was good. The piece spoke very clearly to me, and he was very pleased with what I did with the piece, and that's how he invited me to come to his 80th anniversary. And actually, he wanted me to do the premiere of one of his opera, but because of scheduling, it didn't work at the end. But we are still looking forward to try to do something in the future.
Who are other composers that you have worked with?
Living composer. At the moment in Ulster, where my orchestra is in Northern Ireland, we have Piers Halliwell, which is he's Irish, and he has been working. He's been a while for a lot of time doing there, but actually he's also part of the board of the orchestra, and he's working on a new piece that we were going to perform when the orchestra goes to the proms in 2016. And there are some, because my orchestra in Belfast have some relationship with the BBC, there's always new composition and new things coming from all the spectrum that they have. We did, I think it was in last April, it was an Australian composer that at the moment slipped my mind what was his name because of the Commonwealth country, that we did some music. So there's always, all the time, we try to program new music in our way to put the program there in Belfast.
Mm-hmm. Was that Brett Dean?
No. I'm sure that it, by the time that the name comes to me, this will be over. Sorry.
Okay. Okay. Well, we talked about Rostropovich, and Rostropovich played a pivotal role. You could compare it to Joachim and Brahms, both with Shostakovich, with Prokofiev, and then with Benjamin Britten. Alyssa, what about your role in creation of new works?
Actually, it's good that you mentioned Rostropovich again, because he's really my example in terms of expanding the repertoire, particularly the cello repertoire, which is sadly quite small. It's great, but it's very small in comparison to the violin and piano repertoire. So, in fact, I feel very lucky. I have close relationships with several composers now. And in fact, so this season I'm premiering two new concerti. One is by Matthias Pinscher, the wonderful German composer, and the other, so that we'll do the world premiere in Copenhagen, actually, with the Danish National Orchestra. And we will also do it the VDR Cologne. And it was actually the lead commissioner's, the Boston Symphony. And we'll do that. We'll do the North American premiere, the following season. And then the other concerto, which was written for me and premiering, is by Pascal Dussapin, the French composer, and we'll premiere that with the Chicago Symphony later this season. So very, very excited about that. And I also work with a wonderful Philadelphia composer, Joseph Hallman, who's written a lot of really, really wonderful music for me, both orchestral and chamber music and recital. Lara Auerbach.
John Adams is writing something for you as well.
What?
John Adams.
John Adams? Well, that's
yes.
Later. Oswaldo Golijov, of course, I also worked with quite a lot. And he revised his cello concerto for me. And there's some others as well, which I should stop mentioning names, otherwise I'll offend people that I've left out.
You mentioned Lyra Auerbach, yeah. And many of us remember her when she was a student in Aspen, and she's actually come back both as composer and piano soloist.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. She's a polymath. She's a poet, she's an artist, she's a, and a wonderful, wonderful composer. So,
when you're working with composers, do you find yourself offering suggestions? I don't want to say corrections, but...
it depends. It's funny because working with Osvaldo Golijov, for example, is completely different from working with Lera. Lera is incredibly specific, knows exactly what she wants, and she won't hesitate to tell a performer, no, this is absolutely not the character that I want this instead. With Osvaldo, it's a bit more, I'd say, collaborative. He said, well, does this work for the cello, or does this not? And he'll, in fact, when he was revising the cello concerto, he said, just play for me, play some solo cello repertoire. I just want to hear some things. So I played Bach, I played Kodály, I played, many other things. And he said, okay. And then he came up with a concerto, pretty much. So it was interesting.
Golijov incorporates more improvisation into his work than many composers.
Most definitely. That's absolutely true. Yeah. And Matthias Pinscher is also extremely specific about dynamics, colors, and everything else. Although when it was interesting when I played his cello concerto, which was written in 2005, which is called Reflections on Narcissus, which is a wonderful piece, full of colors and drama, and it's a fantastic vehicle for the cello as well. But he gave me incredible interpretive freedom, much more than I thought he might, given what was actually printed in the score. So that was very interesting to me.
Well, Matthias Pinscher, since we're just touring all these names, has also been frequently a guest in Aspen. I'm sad he hasn't been here for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Protégé of Pierre Boulez, and just as Raphael has succeeded Maestro Mazel, Matthias succeeded Boulez, not directly, but after an interim with the Ensemble Intercontemporain.
That's in correct,
Paris.
He's
a good guy, and we premiered a piece of his with Enon Barnaton.
Right, and of course,
So, now, I said we would have questions, and then I turned away from the audience. Let's go right down here first.
Do you know if there has been any cutback in funding for El Sistema since the difficulties with dropping oil price in Venezuela and the fiscal restraints and cutback in funding, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, somehow I know my country has been struggling with a lot of problems at the moment with all the oil prices and everything, but in a remarkable way, El Sistema is the only thing that has not been affected by it. Somehow, I don't know how is the way they do it to try to create, but the Sistema has been always protected. It's like in a bubble, even though in the past, because this is not the first time that Venezuela has gone through a crisis, not as bad as the one that is now, but of course, there are a little bit of cuts on some things, but Maestro Abreu is very, very absolutely genius. And sometimes if there are some cuts from some places, he just find a way to try to even up with some other stuff. But even though, let's say, outside the musical world, the country has been trembling, the musical world in Venezuela is just really going all the time. Very, very fast and very high. So that's, in one sense, very good because people could escape from all the problems just focusing in the music a little bit.
If there's something I can add to that, part of José Antonio Abreu's vision, as you say, of course, it is not only a music program and not only for a select few. It is a social welfare program. And also he said, if children can be spiritually nourished through music, you will have done something that's really, really worthwhile. So I think that's something that's needed more than ever now. Mm-hmm. So,
another question concerning El Sistema. Could you describe how, or the extent that it is evident in U.S. education?
In U.S. education, I can talk too much about that.
I can. When I was the dean of New England Conservatory, which was in the 90s, we developed a very strong interest in El Sistema, and in fact were the first conservatory to go down to Venezuela and to visit, and have maintained that. And so the beginning of an organization called El Sistema USA was there, and El Sistema USA now has 75 affiliates, 75 cities in the U.S., have active El Sistema programs, which to varying degrees are modeled on the Venezuelan design. There are certain aspects of it, I don't want to go on too long here, but there are certain aspects of what has happened in Venezuela that we all felt would not transfer exactly to the U.S., and so some things have been adapted. But one thing, and here I would ask Rafael and Alyssa, who's very knowledgeable about Venezuela, to comment on, one aspect is the extraordinary intensity of time that the children spend. So in a conventional U.S. program, you might get 1 hour of lesson a week, and you might get an hour or 90 minutes of ensemble a week, and you progress at a certain rate. But if you're working every single day, I mean 6 days a week, and having intense coachings and having an older student practice with you, so the youngest kids practice with the middle kids, and the middle kids practice with the older kids, and so there's so much contact with the music that the rate of learning is much faster. I'm going to see if...
Yes, indeed. In this part, that's one of the, let's say, unorthodox thing that make El Sistema quite different, is that in everywhere you have to, in every country outside Venezuela, you have your theoretical lessons, you have your instrument lessons, and maybe you will have an ensemble. In Venezuela, everything happens at the same time. You start, sometimes you learn everything in the orchestra. I could say that for my own experience, that I learned how to read a different clef, because I'm a horn player, by reading Beethoven Fifth Symphony. So sometimes you just get the full immersion on everything. And let's face it, when you are a kid, if you see that your other colleague or your other companion is having this, and you see, well, if he can, I also can. So it's the natural way of, well, I could also do it. So you actually improve and learn faster. Sometimes, of course, you could get bad manners or something that then needs to be fixed. But the whole approach of having everything all together at the same time, you are not exposed by yourself, which it could also be a problem, because if you are alone, you know, to practice or to be in front of an audience might be difficult. But if you are with your neighbor, you will feel a little bit more stronger. And that's one of the, let's say, keys on El Sistema development.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And the other thing which I found so impressive with going to visit many, not only in Caracas, but in many other small towns, is how children learned how to be respectful of one another and be kind to one another, because they were trained to create something beautiful together. And they learn to feel proud of themselves, and you know, to have this spiritual nourishment. And for example, there was I think you remember we went to a school in Coro, which is town in the northwest of Venezuela, and a relatively poor neighborhood. And we went to see the local school, which they call Núcleos in Venezuela. And there was a group of children between the ages of 7 and 12. Playing beautifully together, you know, all levels. You know, they didn't make the most refined sound, of course, but they were playing very beautifully together, perfectly in time, and completely respectful of the instructor. And you know, I came to meet them. They were just gorgeous children. And so I went to compliment the teacher, and she said, "Wow, well, thank you, but you should have seen them when I got them a year ago. I tried to get them to share a microphone, and they started whapping each other on the head with it." And it was impossible to imagine that these were the same children that she got a year ago. I mean, they were completely courteous, lovely, getting along beautifully. And it's amazing to see that the effect that had on them.
So I will say Denver has an El Sistema organization. Now by far the largest in the U.S. is in Los Angeles, which is not coincidental, since Gustavo Dudamel came up through El Sistema. But what they're doing in Los Angeles is really striking and important. Also on the East Coast, the Bard College Conservatory, which is in Boston, has Bard College Conservatory is in Rhinebeck, but their Longsheet division is in Boston. And they are now spearheading a lot. So I'm not at liberty to say more than this, but you can look for a collaboration of El Sistema USA programs, Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Aspen Music Festival and School. So we're working on it.
Aside from the recent Beethoven's Ninth, I believe you've been the soloist when Raphael is the conductor.
Correct.
And what's that like, and what do you two have coming up together?
Oh, we fight a lot. No, I'm just kidding. In fact, we played the Prokofiev Symphonia Concertante 6 times on a tour of New Zealand recently.
A year ago.
Yeah, exactly a year ago. It's true. And we have actually quite a lot coming up.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, we have BBC Scottish.
Yeah, exactly.
You will be playing Shostakovich's Encore.
Yeah.
I think you're playing Prokofiev in Cincinnati, isn't it?
No, Shostakovich.
I don't know, but CBSO.
We talk about repertoire like this too. CBSO is Prokofiev. But actually, we've gone through quite a lot of the cello repertoire already. We've done Dvorak, Elgar, I think Rococo as well, and Haydn is, and we have lots more to do. And working together has actually been really fantastic. This is the most accurate way to say we share core musical values, and they're almost, you know, fundamentally exactly the same between us. So if we have a small difference, that's very easily worked out. It's really fun to talk about music and to discuss it and work through it. So
absolutely. And I think that the core, like you say, is that because our way of making music is basically the same. I mean, we really the way we see the overall is always in a very intense way and passion. Yes, fine, but our way of making music is actually literally the same, like you just said. And it's always wonderful when we come to make music. We are just looking forward to it because we could share ideas and say like, maybe I never think this way, or like, do you think that this should be the way? Maybe not. Maybe actually that works better. So it's always wonderful to have this experience.
I agree completely.
And down here,
this is a question regarding scheduling. I noticed that in two months of the festival, not a single Wagner piece has been programmed. Could you explain why, of all the composers that you program, 2 months go by without one single Wagner? Huh. Why?
Well, this was not deliberate. We did not announce a no Wagner zone. I remember a couple of seasons ago when we ended with a big Wagner program on the final Sunday. I think that was the Peter Grimes year, actually. Yeah. So we had used the Colorado Symphony Chorus in Peter Grimes, and thus didn't have a chorus for the final Sunday. And we had Eric Ullins doing excerpts from The Ring. But a problem in Wagner is almost entirely it requires very big voices. And there are very few opportunities for orchestral only, and we have cycled through them all. I mean, what Robert Spano calls great bleeding chunks of The Ring. There are excerpts, Siegfried's Funeral March and The Ride of the Valkyries and things that you can do with orchestra alone, but we've really been doing them a lot. I feel as though we have Siegfried Idol coming up. I think it's on this season. I think I'm looking for Asador, but he seems to have stepped out. Really?
Next year.
Okay. It might. Siegfried Idol might be lurking on a chamber music program where you didn't spot it. As for myself, I think Siegfried Idol should be played at every summer festival, like at least every other year. I promise you there was no intention to slight Wagner. I'm going to ask a thought question, and I don't know how I would answer it, so I'm putting my guests on the spot. But Alyssa, you mentioned Haydn, Tchaikovsky, Rococo, there's Brahms' Double, there's Dvorak, Elgar, Shostakovich, Prokofiev. What have I missed?
Sassons, Penderecki, Dutilleux, Britain, Lutoslavsky, Ligeti.
Also, how many cello concertos would you say are in the standard repertoire?
Standard meaning?
That if you go to most orchestras around the world and you subscribe, that within two or three seasons you're going to hear them.
Well, so very standard repertoire, maybe not more than 10 or 12. And then the rest are not programmed too often. And even some of those in the standard repertoire are not programmed very often. For example, the Prokofiev, for practical reasons. You know, as you say, Wagner is not programmed this year for practical reasons only, not because it's not great music. Prokofiev is... it's been very interesting. So I've really pushed for it to be programmed in many, many places because I believe so strongly in the piece. And orchestra after orchestra tells me, well, we haven't played this piece in 20 years. Or I've never played this piece, and how fantastic, because it's so rich in material. It's like going to a museum where you see picture after picture after picture, and it's kind of like this kaleidoscopic kind of language, and it's just incredible. Music is a masterpiece, and it should be played much more often.
So, Rafael, do you agree with Alyssa about 10 or 12
maybe
standard
less.
Works?
Maybe less.
Yeah, it's generous, right. It's true.
Because I know that, I know from my experience how hard she has been pushing, for instance, the Prokofiev, which is, it should be considered standard, and it's actually not often a play. They usually go for Elgar, Dvorak, Schumann,
Haydn's
and Tchaikovsky.
And maybe Shostakovich one, maybe.
Yeah. And Saint-Saëns, maybe.
But. Yeah, I don't think we've had Saint-Saëns here in 10 seasons. We have not had Rococo in 10 seasons.
Well, there you go.
Now,
this is why we have to expand the repertoire.
Yes. Now, Rafael, how many violin concertos are in the standard repertoire?
Ooh.
We're not going to hold you to this. I'm just wondering.
There are maybe more. I mean, it just depends on how big do you want that half will be. If you want a very extended or if you want smaller pieces. I mean, the violin is not as large as the piano, but...
You already have five Mozart concerti for...
Yeah, so let's count all the Mozarts.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah, I mean, if you go for, of course, Brahms, Sibelius, Beethoven...
Mendelssohn, Tchaikovsky.
Yeah, I mean, just to name Szymanowski, Britten, Stravinsky, Berg, Bartok... Just, and I'm sure that...
Shostakovich.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a lot. And if we went to piano concertos, you would now be getting into dozens and dozens of works.
So this is why, like I said, we try to expand the cello repertoire as much as we can. So and we cellists also owe so much to Rostropovich for immensely expanding the cello repertoire and having so many, being the muse for so many great composers.
Well, we are coming to the end of the hour. We could take one more question or comment, and we'll go here.
Wondering where the home base is, considering your musical lives.
Well, the most accurate answer is airplanes.
Hotels.
Hotels. Yes. we see each other quite a lot on the road. We work together quite a lot, and we follow each other. When one is free, we go to the other. And the other way around. But officially, New York, Berlin, and Caracas. So you have residences.
Yeah. Great. Well, I am so grateful to Rafael Pajari and Alyssa Wallerstein for being with us today. Thank you.